Chapter 17. Icarus. What goes up? Flying high. The launch of the Macintosh in January 1984 propelled Jobs into an even higher orbit of celebrity, as was evident during a trip to Manhattan he took at the time. He went to a party that Yoko Ono threw for her son, Sean Lennon, and gave the 9-year-old a Macintosh. The boy loved it. The artists Andy Warhol and Keith Haring were there, and they were so enthralled by what they could create with the machine that the contemporary art world almost took an ominous turn. "I drew a circle," Warhol exclaimed proudly after using QuickDraw. Warhol insisted that Jobs take a computer to Mick Jagger. When Jobs arrived at the rock star's townhouse, Jagger seemed baffled. He didn't quite know who Jobs was. Later, Jobs told his team, "I think he was on drugs. Either that or he's brain damaged." Jagger's daughter Jade, however, took to the computer immediately and started drawing with Mac Paint, so Jobs gave it to her instead. He bought the top-floor duplex apartment that he'd shown Scully in the San Remo on Manhattan's Central Park West and hired James Freed of I.M. Pei's firm to renovate it, but he never moved in. He would later sell it to Bono for $15 million. He also bought an old Spanish colonial-style 14-bedroom mansion in Woodside, in the hills above Palo Alto, that had been built by a copper baron, which he moved into but never got around to furnishing. At Apple, his status revived. Instead of seeking ways to curtail Jobs' authority, Scully gave him more. The Lisa and Macintosh divisions were folded together, with Jobs in charge. He was flying high, but this did not serve to make him more mellow. Indeed, there was a memorable display of his brutal honesty when he stood in front of the combined Lisa and Macintosh teams to describe how they would be merged. His Macintosh group leaders would get all of the top positions, he said, and a quarter of the Lisa staff would be laid off. "You guys failed," he said, looking directly at those who had worked on the Lisa. "You're a B team. B players. Too many people here are B or C players. So today, we are releasing some of you to have the opportunity to work at our sister companies here in the Valley." Bill Atkinson, who had worked on both teams, thought it was not only callous, but unfair. "These people had worked really hard and were brilliant engineers," he said. But Jobs had latched on to what he believed was a key management lesson from his Macintosh experience. You have to be ruthless if you want to build a team of A players. It's too easy as a team grows to put up with a few B players, and they then attract a few more B players, and soon you will even have some C players, he recalled. "The Macintosh experience taught me that A players like to work only with other A players, which means you can't indulge B players." For the time being, Jobs and Scully were able to convince themselves that their friendship was still strong. They professed their fondness so effusively and often that they sounded like high school sweethearts at a Hallmark card display. The first anniversary of Scully's arrival came in May 1984, and to celebrate, Jobs lured him to a dinner party at Le Mouton Noir, an elegant restaurant in the hills southwest of Cupertino. To Scully's surprise, Jobs had gathered the Apple board, its top managers, and even some East Coast investors. As they all congratulated him during cocktails, Scully recalled, a beaming Steve stood in the background, nodding his head up and down and wearing a Cheshire Cat smile on his face. Jobs began the dinner with a fulsome toast. "The happiest 2 days for me were when Macintosh shipped and when John Scully agreed to join Apple," he said. "This has been the greatest year I've ever had in my whole life because I've learned so much from John." He then presented Scully with a montage of memorabilia from the year. In response, Scully effused about the joys of being Jobs' partner for the past year, and he concluded with a line that, for different reasons, everyone at the table found memorable. "Apple has one leader," he said, "Steve and me." He looked across the room, caught Jobs' eye, and watched him smile. "It was as if we were communicating with each other," Scully recalled. But he also noticed that Arthur Rock and some of the others were looking quizzical, perhaps even skeptical. They were worried that Jobs was completely rolling him. They had hired Scully to control Jobs, and now it was clear that Jobs was the one in control. Scully was so eager for Steve's approval that he was unable to stand up to him, Rock recalled. Keeping Jobs happy and deferring to his expertise may have seemed like a smart strategy to Scully, but he failed to realize that it was not in Jobs' nature to share control. Deference did not come naturally to him. He began to become more vocal about how he thought the company should be run. At the 1984 business strategy meeting, for example, he pushed to make the company's centralized sales and marketing staffs bid on the right to provide their services to the various product divisions. This would have meant, for example, that the Macintosh group could decide not to use Apple's marketing team and instead create one of its own. No one else was in favor, but Jobs kept trying to ram it through. "People were looking to me to take control, to get him to sit down and shut up, but I didn't," Scully recalled. As the meeting broke up, he heard someone whisper, "Why doesn't Scully shut him up?" When Jobs decided to build a state-of-the-art factory in Fremont to manufacture the Macintosh, his aesthetic passions and controlling nature kicked into high gear. He wanted the machinery to be painted in bright hues, like the Apple logo, but he spent so much time going over paint chips that Apple's manufacturing director, Matt Carter, finally just installed them in their usual beige and gray. When Jobs took a tour, he ordered that the machines be repainted in the bright colors he wanted. Carter objected. This was precision equipment, and repainting the machines could cause problems. He turned out to be right. One of the most expensive machines, which got painted bright blue, ended up not working properly and was dubbed Steve's Folly. Finally, Carter quit. It took so much energy to fight him, and it was usually over something so pointless that finally I had enough, he recalled. Jobs tapped as a replacement Debbie Coleman, the spunky but good-natured Macintosh financial officer, who had once won the team's annual award for the person who best stood up to Jobs. But she knew how to cater to his whims when necessary. When Apple's art director, Clement Mock, informed her that Jobs wanted the walls to be pure white, she protested. "You can't paint a factory pure white. There's going to be dust and stuff all over," Mock replied. "There's no white that's too white for Steve." She ended up going along. With its pure white walls and its bright blue, yellow, and red machines, the factory floor looked like an Alexander Calder showcase, said Coleman. When asked about his obsessive concern over the look of the factory, Jobs said it was a way to ensure a passion for perfection. "I'd go out to the factory, and I'd put on a white glove to check for dust. I'd find it everywhere, on machines, on the tops of the racks, on the floor, and I'd ask Debbie to get it cleaned. I told her I thought we should be able to eat off the floor of the factory." Well, this drove Debbie up the wall. She didn't understand why, and I couldn't articulate it back then. See, I'd been very influenced by what I'd seen in Japan. Part of what I greatly admired there, and part of what we were lacking in our factory, was a sense of teamwork and discipline. If we didn't have the discipline to keep that place spotless, then we weren't going to have the discipline to keep all these machines running. One Sunday morning, Jobs brought his father to see the factory. Paul Jobs had always been fastidious about making sure that his craftsmanship was exacting and his tools in order, and his son was proud to show that he could do the same. Coleman came along to give the tour. Steve was like beaming, she recalled. He was so proud to show his father this creation. Jobs explained how everything worked, and his father seemed truly admiring. He kept looking at his father, who touched everything and loved how clean and perfect everything looked. Things were not quite as sweet when Danielle Mitterrand toured the factory. The Cuba-admiring wife of France's socialist president, François Mitterrand, asked a lot of questions through her translator about the working conditions, while Jobs, who had grabbed Alain Rossman to serve as his translator, kept trying to explain the advanced robotics and technology. After Jobs talked about the just-in-time production schedules, she asked about overtime pay. He was annoyed, so he described how automation helped him keep down labor costs, a subject he knew would not delight her. "Is it hard work?" she asked. "How much vacation time do they get?" Jobs couldn't contain himself. "If she's so interested in their welfare," he said to her translator, "tell her she can come work here any time." The translator turned pale and said nothing. After a moment, Rossman stepped in to say, in French, "Monsieur Jobs says he thanks you for your visit and your interest in the factory." Neither Jobs nor Madame Mitterrand knew what happened, Rossman recalled, but her translator looked very relieved. Afterward, as he sped his Mercedes down the freeway toward Cupertino, Jobs fumed to Rossman about Madame Mitterrand's attitude. At one point, he was going just over 100 miles per hour when a policeman stopped him and began writing a ticket. After a few minutes, as the officer scribbled away, Jobs honked. "Excuse me," the policeman said. Jobs replied, "I'm in a hurry." Amazingly, the officer didn't get mad. He simply finished writing the ticket and warned that if Jobs was caught going over 55 again, he would be sent to jail. As soon as the policeman left, Jobs got back on the road and accelerated to 100. "He absolutely believed that the normal rules didn't apply to him," Rossman marveled. His wife Joanna Hoffman saw the same thing when she accompanied Jobs to Europe a few months after the Macintosh was launched. "He was just completely obnoxious and thinking he could get away with anything," she recalled. In Paris, she had arranged a formal dinner with French software developers, but Jobs suddenly decided he didn't want to go. Instead, he shut the car door on Hoffman and told her he was going to see the poster artist Fallon instead. "The developers were so pissed off they wouldn't shake our hands," she said. In Italy, he took an instant dislike to Apple's general manager, a soft, rotund guy who had come from a conventional business. Jobs told him bluntly that he was not impressed with his team or his sales strategy. "You don't deserve to be able to sell the Mac," Jobs said coldly. But that was mild compared to his reaction to the restaurant the hapless manager had chosen. Jobs demanded a vegan meal, but the waiter very elaborately proceeded to dish out a sauce filled with sour cream. Jobs got so nasty that Hoffman had to threaten him. She whispered that if he didn't calm down, she was going to pour her hot coffee on his lap. The most substantive disagreements Jobs had on the European trip concerned sales forecasts. Using his reality distortion field, Jobs was always pushing his team to come up with higher projections. He kept threatening the European managers that he wouldn't give them any allocations unless they projected bigger forecasts. They insisted on being realistic, and Hoffman had to referee. "By the end of the trip, my whole body was shaking uncontrollably," Hoffman recalled. It was on this trip that Jobs first got to know Jean-Louis Gasset, Apple's manager in France. Gasset was among the few to stand up successfully to Jobs on the trip. "He has his own way with the truth," Gasset later remarked. The only way to deal with him was to outbully him. When Jobs made his usual threat about cutting down on France's allocations if Gasset didn't jack up sales projections, Gasset got angry. "I remember grabbing his lapel and telling him to stop, and then he backed down. I used to be an angry man myself. I am a recovering assaholic. so I could recognize that in Steve. Gasset was impressed, however, at how Jobs could turn on the charm when he wanted to. François Mitterrand had been preaching the gospel of informatique pour tous, computing for all, and various academic experts in technology such as Marvin Minsky and Nicholas Negroponte came over to sing in the choir. Jobs gave a talk to the group at the Hotel Bristol and painted a picture of how France could move ahead if it put computers in all of its schools. Paris also brought out the romantic in him. Both Gasset and Negroponte tell tales of him pining over women while there.